are you? It's good to be back with you once again. I hope you've been enjoying some time off. We are basically just a few days away from going into the new year already. It's absolutely amazing. 2015 gone already. Well, my name is Henrik, and this is Independent Media, pro-European and alt-right. If you are new to the program, check out redicecreations.com for more radio, videos, and of course, news. Our guest is Tito Perdue. He was born in 1938 in Chile and returned home to Alabama in 1941 with his family. Tito graduated from the University of Texas in 1961 and spent some time working in New York City, an experience which garnered him his lifelong hatred of urban life. After holding positions at various university libraries, Tito has devoted himself full-time to writing since 1983. He has 7 novels published to date, many of which deal with the life and times of Leland Pefley. Some of his titles includes Reuben, The Node, and Morning Crafts. He also has a new one coming out called William's House, part of a 4-volume series. We'll spend some time today talking about the subjects of his novels and his life experience, particularly when it comes to standing in opposition to some of the most established, imposed moral taboos of our age. Welcome, Tito. Thank you so much for coming on with us. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, I'm very honored to be here.
Very good. Now, we briefly met at NPI earlier this year, and I know that you are well-versed in a lot of the topics that we discuss in this show, and I'm looking forward to speaking more with you today about your work and about some of your latest books and whatnot. But maybe you can just tell us a little bit about your background first, for those who might not know that much about your work and maybe how you've become attracted to some of the things that, you know, NPI and other conferences address in these times.
Well, it's a fascinating, it's my favorite question, by the way, talking about myself. Let me say that I was actually born in Chile, South America, because my father was employed there as an electrical engineer during the Depression. But when the war, World War II, broke out, he moved us back to the United States, and we settled in Alabama, in the South. I grew up in the South and went to college and was expelled promptly from the first college I went to, and then entered the University of Texas. And I studied there for a couple of years, got bored with it, went to New York City to make my fortune, almost starved to death, went back to Texas to finish my bachelor's degree. I did finish it. Having not yet learned my lesson, I actually went back to New York City and got a job on Wall Street and found it absolutely wretched. I was miserable there. So one thing and another led me to graduate school and went to Indiana University, got a master's degree in librarianship and another master's degree in modern European history. Then got a job at the University of Iowa, followed by a job at Iowa State University, followed by a job at the State University of New York in Binghamton, followed by a job at Emory University in Atlanta, after which time I'd had my fill of American universities. I decided that what I really wanted to do was try to write novels. So I quit, resigned. I was only 44 years old, but because of the kind of person my wife is, I was able to resign. She was willing to subsidize me while I tried to turn into a writer. So I worked at that, and I have been working at it for 30 years now, and I've written 20 novels, of which about half have been published, with a good chance that all of them will eventually be published. And the most recent one to be published is a book called William's House, which is a 4-volume novel that Arctos Media is presently putting out 1 volume at a time. I've enjoyed very good reviews for all of my books, so I'm not sorry that I left academia when I did. Perhaps should have left it even earlier.
Right.
But,
yeah, I hear from many people that do that these days, and they pay for, in some cases, pretty expensive education, and it doesn't bring them that much, you know?
Yeah, no, it's not just the money. I mean, I'd be willing to work very little. if the ambience, you know, if the environment of American academia was accepting to people like me, people who don't, people who don't abide by all the current American social orthodoxies, as I don't. So that if I had remained in academia, I would have been profoundly uncomfortable and probably ostracized. There would have been no chance for promotion or anything of that sort. Not that I much care about that. I probably would never have been allowed to stay. So by leaving it, I just simply took a shortcut and did what I wanted to do before they could do it to me. And I'm not sorry at all. I've been writing novels, enjoying it greatly, and hope to write a few more before I'm finished with it.
Well, let's talk about a few of them, of course. We can discuss William's House a little bit later. I don't know much about that book, but I have read about Reuben and, of course, the journey, if you will, of Lee Pefley, if that's how you pronounce his name. And tell us about the what the book is about and the kind of the, I guess, the fallen state of America, really, and how and why you wanted to write a book in that context.
Are you you're speaking of Reuben now?
Yes.
Well, I've always wanted to write a book about a person who is excellent beyond belief. You know, a sort of a Nietzschean Superman who has excelled in all areas of life. A strong man, you know, a Napoleon or an Alexander, someone who has the ability to take control, to, you know, to seize the world in his fist and turn it around according to his own liking. The book is a fable, you know, it's not realistic and it's not supposed to be realistic. And those who criticize it for not being realistic simply don't understand my intention. It's a fable. So I did that. I wrote a book about a man of amazing intellectual ability, someone who had no education, no formal education, and who is adopted by my perennial hero, Leland Pefley, who takes him into his household, educates him, trains him, and then turns him loose on the world. And he does go out into the world and went step by step, acquires enormous influence and power, becomes a political leader, and carries out some of the changes that you and I might like to see. So that's the story. It's a fable about a special sort of person who's able to do very special sort of things.
Is it an aspiration of some that we are in need of in these dire times, do you think?
I think so. That's what I hope it represents.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about that world and that you describe in the book and how you see that it kind of correlates to where we are today, and later we can get into where you think that we might be tomorrow. I mean, I know you focus on America, of course. We can have focus on that, and we can ask you about Europe a little bit later, but what's going on in America now? What are some of your concerns, how that relates to what you touch upon in the book?
Well, America is founded on a pattern of ideals, including equality, but not exclusively equality. It was concerned primarily with the revolt against the royal administrations of Europe. It was a revolt against royalism. Revolt against aristocracy. And it was an attempt to set up a new kind of civilization that would give heed, not just to liberty but and equality, but to freedom. And a system that would allow people to realize themselves and do as much as they could do. I think that was a good beginning. And it continued to be a good system up until postmodern times, when one of those ideals, namely equality, began to squeeze out all of the others. So that now in modern-day America, social equality is virtually the only dimension of American society that commands attention, from the elite, from our elite newspapers, from our leaders, from our political leaders. The only ideal that seems to have grabbed hold of the public attention, so that we now live in a system in which absolute, across the board, categorical equality is assumed to be the perfect system. The result is, of course, that people of excellence are systematically denigrated, and people who are not at all excellent, but rather very much the opposite, are systematically promoted, so that good people are being demoted, bad people are being promoted, ignorance is confessionable, knowledge is scorned at, the low culture presides, the high culture is ignored, and the rest. It is the horror of absolute equality, or as my good friend Alex Krutajic says, immoral. What could be more immoral than equality? Equality doesn't exist in nature, should not exist in society. Automobiles are not equal, restaurants are not equal, cultures most certainly are not equal, races are conspicuously not equal. And any attempt to pretend that they are and to force them to be so is simply a way of derogating civilization, making high civilization impossible. So that, I think, is my chief concern about modern America, that it is on the wrong trajectory, and that all of the good qualities that it manifested in previous decades have pretty much been brushed aside. And the future is very grim, I think, unless we can have some sort of social rebalancing. So that's my main concern.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is remarkable when you think about it, the talented, the brilliant, the exceptional, what have you, are to a state where they are torn down, as you say, and those that are much lower beyond that are lifted out, lifted up, placed on pedestals and whatnot. I think that this is something which is going to be, and I think we can see it already, but tremendously damaging and detrimental to everybody in the long run. That's what's so ironic about this, that these both leadership but also talented people are people who can give us gifts, if you will, in various ways through their work, you know. And when we begin to tear them down, this is something, their gifts to us is going to stop. That's what I'm saying. And we are going to be effectively feeling the brunt end of that, right?
Of course. You know, Ayn Rand speaks of this in her novel, Atlas Shrugged. I don't think that's a very brilliant piece of art, judged as art, but I think her point is very good, that if all of the talented and gifted people were to go on strike and withhold their gifts from society, society would very quickly begin to crumble. You know, we live in a world where a concert, symphony, might attract 200 or 300, perhaps 200 or 300,000 attendees, and might sell CDs, maybe a couple of thousand CDs, but a piece of rap music, particularly if it's obscene enough, will sell millions, millions. And this is the diet Americans are feeding themselves on. America was never a high culture society. It was never classical Greece or Renaissance Florence or Elizabethan London. But it wasn't always so bad. It wasn't that the gutter was on the throne. I'm reminded of that saying by Nietzsche that filth sitteth on the throne, yea, and the throne on filth.
I think
he had it.
Yeah, it's true. It's incredible at how far this has gone, and I don't quite yet think that we've seen the worst of it, if you will. But we're beginning to kind of come into that cycle now of complete decay, and it's evident in art, it's evident in music, as you say, in basically any cultural and academic aspects. It seems that it is more concerned with tearing down and lifting up the ugly than it is to emphasize some kind of natural order of things.
Absolutely. You know, people are conservative by nature, and they don't want change. Change frightens them. So I suspect this current trajectory will continue until it becomes unendurable. The people don't want to rise up against some prevailing system unless they just have to. Eventually, they will, I think, just have to. And we will see this systematic attack of everything that is difficult, everything that is above normal. That attack will have to give way. And we might once again begin to appreciate things that are better than that. But I'm not sure. I'm not saying that's going to happen. I think that I have to, people like me and you and others, people like people you've interviewed, people like that have to attempt to do that, even if we are not likely to succeed.
Yeah, I mean, from your perspective, let's talk about how we ended up in this mess. You've seen, you know, a lot, obviously, in your life, things changing drastically. I mean, if we look at Europe, they still have aristocracy and royalty, albeit more formal, I guess, but largely the same things are happening there, right, as it is in America. I mean, there's variances and differences and nuances, but largely it's kind of a progression towards or a march of cultural Marxism towards, you know, the cliff, if you will. But how did this happen? How did we end up where we are today?
Well, I have a couple of theories about that. I believe that the Western world adopted democracy and found that it was good. And so they thought that more democracy would be even better. And they thought, finally, that total democracy would be best of all. Kind of like those people who believe that that a violin is good, but not as good as a million of them all played together.
Right. Yeah.
So they decide to opt continually for more and more democracy, or in other words, more and more equality, which is what democracy has come to mean. And I think that's one of the pillars of our decay. The other, I think, is what happened with the Third Reich. The Third Reich was overthrown, of course, and people began to decide that everything that was done by that system, everything, was evil. Therefore, to be good, you have to do always the very opposite.
Right.
So, you know, if racism is bad, then we must get rid of any notion that there is even such a thing as race. That's what modern liberals believe, that there's no such thing as race, which makes it difficult to explain what affirmative action is supposed to do, who is supposed to serve if there's no such thing as race. But obviously there are differences between races. And whether one is better than the other or not is really a moot point, so long as we know that they are different. You know, if one demographic is very good at basketball, another demographic is good at nuclear physics, I think we have the right to choose which demographic we want most to promote and esteem. So I abominate the notion that all races are the same. If someone wants to say they're equal, well, I'm not sure what that means. Equal in what sense? Equal in some sort of metaphysical sense, some spiritual sense? All right, you know, maybe so. But I do know that different cultures have been created by different races. I know that Western culture was created by a Caucasian race, not by the Chinese race. The Chinese could not have created Western civilization, and Westerners could not have created Chinese civilization, although Chinese civilization has been and may again be extraordinarily advanced. I think different races create different cultures. Western culture was created by a specific race at a specific time. And to alter that demographic, dilute it, change it all about, means to alter, change, dilute, move about the culture that it created. Well, it's not doing that. You know, trying to dilute white percentage in our Western Caucasians is doing the opposite of them truly. So I think we should value our antecedents, value our racial inheritance, and be loyal to it, and try to promote it, defend it above all else. It doesn't mean ignoring other races or disparaging them. I think that we would admire other races even more if they were not interlarded with our own. I think that, I was born in Chile. My parents adored Chile and adored the people there. But if 1 million or 5 million Chileans decided to enter into our country, they would not adore that at all.
Right.
And the Chileans would not adore it if 5 million North Americans were intruding to their cause. I mean, you know, whenever anyone used to threaten the Greek civilization, they were called barbarians. Not because they were barbarians, but because they weren't Greeks. And because they wanted to defend themselves and what they had created. I wish to God we would do that.
Wow.
I wish to God that we would consider the obvious fact, Western civilization has contributed more to life on Earth than all other civilizations added up together. We could live in this world without the contributions of other civilizations, and although we have to do without some very fine things, we could do it. We could survive without what they have given us. But if the rest of the world had to do without what we have contributed, it would be absolute misery. I mean, where would they get their eyeglasses? Where would they go to get brain surgery? Where would they go to get their computers? Where would they go to attend an opera? You know, I mean,
yeah.
It's the West. The West is the gold standard of modern civilization. And to dilute it, in my view, is just a civilizational sin that will never be forgiven.
Yeah, it's true. I worry tremendously about this. It seems to me that even the mildest recognition of these differences, of this fact, seems to be one of the main heresies of our times. And I think it was Richard Spencer over on Reddick's Journal. He actually pulled out a comment that you made under a Telegraph article. I just wanted to read a little bit from that. I thought that was good. You're right. Racism is a wonderful institution that should be rejuvenated and inculcated in schools. It is the last barrier to global homogenization and represents the default position of 99% of humanity over 99% of historical time. A natural and indeed necessary sentiment, racism is just one method for people to evaluate others in accord with their genetic value. Without racism, the world would today be dominated by Neanderthals, or by the class of people who mostly inhabit sub-Saharan Africa. Civilization requires the leadership of society's best people. Those areas governed by less advanced demographics fall quickly into barbarism, as we see in so many places. In normal times, racism is so universally experienced that historians hardly bother to call attention to it. It's only in diseased and perverted eras like our own that elites rail against this ineradicable and precious human attribute. And you've gone to say, hate, too, is a necessary and valuable component of life, and anyone devoid of hate, I've never known such a person, isn't living a complete life. It's a good passage. Do you want to tell us a bit more about that? I don't know if you remember the comment, by the way.
I do, yeah, I remember it, and I stick by it, you know. I tried to say in one paragraph what I believe. Also, I wanted to say in one paragraph what I thought liberals might find to be most offensive. I'm always trying to find some way to verbalize ideas that the progressives will hate. And I do get a good deal of hatred from them, which I welcome and revel in. I always have to get more. If you know of any way I can increase the hatred that I can receive from liberals, please let me know what it is so that I can engage in it.
And it will make them identify with that emotion that they deny to others, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's good. It would point out. Well, I mean, it's true what you're right. We're trying to create a society, a world, well, at least only in the Western world, because that seems to be the main priorities where these kinds of ideas are enforced. But you know, to hold out very normal human emotions, natural states, processes of our psyche, which has been there. Both for reasons of survival, but also to make determinations about our world and our surrounding. And it's just something that never is going to work, in my opinion. What do you think?
Well, you know, what the left seems to want is to create a frictionless world without conflict, in which everyone will gather together and hold hands, sing folk songs together, go down to the beach and have a clam bake. In a world like that, people would People would die of boredom within 10 minutes. You know, it would be a hell on earth. Conflict is what makes the world go around. Conflict is necessary for advancement. We need a lot more conflict. The Greeks, whom are my favorite people, were in constant conflict. And when there weren't any foreign enemies, they would slaughter each other. someone called ancient Greece a beehive, you know, of mutually antagonistic insects who are at each other's throat all the time. What was the result? The greatest civilization the world has ever seen. It is conflict that drives history. The liberals don't seem to understand this a bit. The world that they want to create, truly, would be a hell on earth. A world without striving, a world without ego, a world without art or beauty, a world without achievement. It would be no world that any reputable, admirable human being would ever want to participate in.
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously that goes against so much of the liberal, the progressive programming that we get in these days, in terms of this intense fear for not only for conflict, but for anything that basically is you know, hurting people emotionally, even in some cases, that they don't seem to understand, just as you say, that there has to be incentives, if you will, for us to try harder, to try to. To a certain extent, outsmart the competition or the enemy too, if you'd like. And I think that if we are devoid from that, that progression in us, that drive to try to overcome, is something that would cease, you know. And I think as well, just as you say, I think that this would create a society which is so stagnant in its development that it would be horrible to live within it. I think actually we're starting to see this in some European societies, and I'm ashamed to say it, but I think Sweden, my country, has suffered from this. You know, we've had no wars for about 250 years, and yes, sure, it has created in some cases a material wealth where we could spend resources on other things. But I think that this lack of conflict and this lack of recognition of the problems, if you will, has led us to a situation now where we are so naive for the people that we're letting in that we can't even comprehend that they come with different attitudes when it comes to, for example, violence or taking what they want, etc. If you see what I'm saying.
I see exactly what you're saying. And I think Britain is the chief exemplar of that. Those people who become so sensitive, so touchy-feely, they cannot bear the thought of being offended or offending anyone. The result is that they live in an unreal world. When they come face-to-face, as eventually we'll probably have to, when they come face-to-face with a rising Pacific Rim culture that will want to devour them alive, they won't be able to defend themselves. You know, too bad for Hitler that Britain weren't like that in 1940. They would have surrendered. They would have rolled out the carpet.
Right.
They would not have wanted to offend him. In Britain, you know, to offend someone is equal to a war crime. These people just lost touch with truth, lost touch with reality. And I don't see how young Britons can ever hope to grow up if they're to live in this vacuum, this unreal world where they never face opposition or conflict, where they never are insulted or bullied. Of course, bullying is considered the prime crime today.
Yeah.
I mean, how on earth will they ever develop? I think we live in a feminized age. I think that the sensibilities of women have taken over. You know, Britain used to be called John Bull because it was this steadfast, masculine country, the one that knew how to stand up to Napoleon, this unshakable bulwark of the sea. Today, I don't think they could stand up against Liechtenstein. You know, they are as soft as candy. And I would be embarrassed to be a Briton today. I don't see how they can manage to stand up straight. I think it's true, of course, of all of Europe and all of America. Some places more than others. Canada, for example, is just as bad as Britain. They've got a new leader over there who has the mindset of a 12-year-old girl. How on earth are these societies supposed to sustain themselves? They won't. They won't sustain themselves. And decadence is bitten so deep into Western society that it won't survive, and in fact, probably shouldn't survive.
Well, you know, someone pointed out, and see if I can explain this correct, I'd like to get your take on this, but someone pointed out to me that nature finds a way, well, let's put it like this. If there is a vacuum or space somewhere, nature will find a way to fill that with life, basically, and an essence. And something will move itself into that space, especially if there is energy or nutrition or something to be gained from that which you can live off of. And I think what we're seeing in many European countries now is this exact thing. It's almost like while we have learned to become almost... What do you call it? We're not in existence even. We're not allowed to leave a mark on the earth, right? We're talking about our carbon footprint, and we're supposed to live like we're not even exist to a certain extent. Despite that, we're of course producing still a lot of wealth. There is an abundance of food, etc. And what's happening is that nature seems to have found a way to make sure that the populations come in that are like filling up that space, that are taking up that that room, if you will. Now, of course, having said that, yes, there's a lot of political decisions, there's a lot of things going on within the establishment, etc., that has allowed this, but I think the person who talked about it still kind of explained that at the end of the day, it's still nature that is kind of the main ruler, even if it's acting itself through the psychotic minds of politicians or what have you. But what would you say to that idea that it's like we are there as ghosts and now someone else is coming in to fill that void?
It's not just nature, it's history. If history allows a vacuum to open up, it will most certainly be filled, and it will be filled by stronger populations. The Islamists now flooding into Europe are fertile people who have 6, 12, 8 children each, while white people have just about given up on reproduction. They will be the future. Of course they will. They believe in it. They believe in something. What do white people believe in? Money? Sex? White people don't believe in anything. Muslims, what they believe in may be absurd, but they believe it. That's what matters. And they're strong because they believe it. Our religion is vanishing. Their religion is getting stronger. They are. They send males to colonize Europe. Soon those males will want to bring their wives, grandparents, mothers, and children. All of those people will themselves be reproducing and practicing their religion. White people will stand aside aghast, not knowing what to do, wringing their hands, afraid to offend them. And soon the white people will become a subservient class. They will become helots in their own lands. Any of the people that allows that to happen to them are finished, are historically obsolete. They will deserve what they get, and they're going to get it.
Has anything like this happened, do you think, before in history? We've had large population movements, of course, the migration age, etc. These were tremendously, kind of dramatic periods, if you will. But this aspect, that territory and ultimately also resources are being handed over, albeit against many people's will, but still, there's still a lot of people in agreement, in accordance with it. But has anything like that ever happened, do you think?
It happened in my country when the Europeans invaded the northern part of the Western Hemisphere. The Indians, many of them, actually welcomed white people. The greatest mistake they could possibly have made. Later, they began to resist, and resist very bravely, but they were quickly outnumbered, and the civilization that they had created, although it was not a very high civilization, not much better than the old Stone Age, it was their civilization. And it was crushed, overwhelmed. It was the most perfect case of genocide in the history of the world. Today, the descendants of Indians are impoverished, alcoholic, and live on reservations in out-of-the-way places. That's what happens when you are unable or unwilling to resist the invasion of your homeland. And that is what will happen to the Caucasian peoples if they do not quickly grow a pair and begin to resist. I just don't, except for that invasion of North America by the Europeans, I cannot easily think of any other example.
Yeah.
The ancient peoples I know would always resist, and even the lands occupied by the Romans resisted, tried to, but even the lands invaded by Hitler resisted, even Poland tried, but and they tried, so you don't fault them. But people who don't resist, what can you say about them?
Yeah, someone said even a worm squirms and pushes itself up against the shoe that crushes it, despite that it might be futile, they still fight back, you know. The situation is a little bit different, though, isn't it? I mean, I think first, many of them, since they're not Syrian refugees, many of them are come from other countries in Northern Africa, other parts of Asia. A lot of people are taking this opportunity to come as economic migrants, which means that they are coming to us for something that they want from us, right? It's a need there. And technologically, we're still very much more advanced than them. Does that matter in this equation, do you think? Do we not have still an upper hand to a certain extent, although we haven't quite understood that what this really is about at the end of the day?
What they want is to share wealth that they did not create, wealth that they could not create. In other words, theft. They wish to come into an economy that would provide them with much better employment opportunities than any that they could find anywhere else. The people who create those employment opportunities will be relinquishing those opportunities to people of an alien race who come simply for opportunistic reasons. It does not matter if they come as refugees or whether they come as people fleeing war. It doesn't matter why they come. I don't care if they're starving to death. I don't want them in my country because they will destroy my country, and I want to preserve my country. If they cannot create sufficient economies in their own countries, if they aren't able to create wealth enough to survive them, then they shouldn't survive.
Yeah, it's a very dire and very strange situation of what has happened this past summer in Europe, with, of course, Merkel and I'd say some politicians in other parts of Europe that are openly advocating this. They're not doing anything about sending a signal or a message to these people that, you know, we don't want you, or we're full, we can't handle it, etc. It's cost certain countries to very late in the game taking measures, though, like Sweden, for example, which at some point they realized that they can't handle it. They can't even house these people. No matter how well intended they are, it would be to their detriment. I think the damage, though, even despite that the border was enforced late in the game, the damage is and has been done already. And I think that this is going to change dramatically the face of Europe in the next few years. What do you think is going to happen? How is this going to play out and change things?
I don't think the damage has begun. Wait until these refugees try to fit themselves into Swedish or German society. Wait until they try to find employment. Wait until they begin demanding welfare. Wait until they begin going to emergency rooms and not expecting to have to pay for it. Wait until they begin going to Swedish schools or German schools and cannot speak the language. Or wait until they begin going to German schools and find out that they despise German culture, despise Swedish principles, despise democracy, despise what remains of Christianity. That's when the trouble begins. They won't fit in. They don't want to fit in. They don't want to be citizens of Sweden. They want to be the rulers of Sweden, eventually, according to the principles, according to the theology of their religion, which is that everybody in the world must eventually become a Muslim. You know, they're very good at hiding all of this in the beginning. They won't tell you that they want to kill you. Not until they feel safe. Not until they have embedded themselves in Swedish or German society, and wait until their menfolk have become successful or fairly successful. Wait until they've become an important part or semi-important part of the Swedish economy, and they feel invulnerable. Then, suddenly, you're going to find yourself under attack. You'll find yourself under intellectual attack. you'll suddenly find newspapers springing up in foreign languages explaining how Swedish culture needs to make room for them, that their own culture is just as good and probably better than Swedish culture. They'll explain how all Swedish children must learn Arabic. They will be explaining how it wouldn't hurt at all if the Swedish language itself went out of existence. That wouldn't be a bad thing at all. It wouldn't be bad at all if every Swede was required to marry an Arab lady. That's going to be, but it's already the problem. Think of the United States. Our population is only 13% African. And Africans have been a minor part of our civilization 400 years. We have had 400 years to learn to get along together.
Mm-hmm.
We can't get along together today. We get along less well today than we did 100 years ago.
Yep, that's right.
So the idea that races and religions that are highly unlike, the idea that they can meld together, the idea that they can become homogenous, no, it has never worked. There has never been a successful empire, and that's what an empire is. An empire is a polity of different kinds of people. No empire has ever succeeded. Those that have lasted for very long have become miserable places. You know, the Babylonian Empire fell apart, the Assyrian Empire, the Assyrian Empire, the Elamite Empire, the Athenian Empire, the Roman Empire, the British, French, Netherlandic, the Hitlerites, Soviet Empire. All were wretched places that quickly fell apart. The Austro-Hungarian Empire is the gold standard when it comes to falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
One time, Austria-Hungary ruled over half a dozen very different demographics. And they were destroyed. They broke down after the First World War into half a dozen different mutually hostile countries. It was inevitable. And now the United States is trying to set up an empire, mostly an economic empire, where the United States tries to govern other nations through economic leverage, trying to do it in Iraq. You know, they actually built the largest embassy in the world in Baghdad. American embassy in Baghdad was to be the largest in the world. It was from that building that American capitalists hoped to govern the Middle East. They were going to upset some governments and promote others, subsidize some, bomb others, and set up a free market democratic paradise over there where everybody can become more and more like Americans. It's failing. It's not working. Putin doesn't want it. Most of the Middle Eastern countries that pretend to admire America, they don't want it. I don't even, Saudi Arabia doesn't want it. Even Israel doesn't entirely want it. Our colony called Israel. So the idea of banging together unlike peoples, unlike languages, unlike religions, leads inevitably to disaster. The best system is the nation state of a people that are related to each other, who can create coherent, stable, friendly societies where people actually care about each other. I think the best society is the city state, like Florence, like Elizabethan London, or like ancient Athens, where people know each other, or probably even related to each other, have the same mental processes, the same religion, the same aspirations. That works. And it works beautifully, and it generally turned out to be the most creative societies in history. The idea, the purpose of creating multicultural societies is an enormous error, doomed to failure.
Mm.
And my purpose is it cannot fail quickly enough.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying. And of course, in the wake of this experiment, this ongoing experiment, it's causing so much damage. And I'm worrying about how this is to be restored, if anyway. Maybe that's something I'm going to ask you a little bit later about. We can get into that more in detail in the second hour. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, just as you say, the more and more different people you bring in from these different, very incompatible cultures, the more difficult it is to keep peace between them. All these different groups end up fighting for their own interests and just try to get ahead, and it becomes more and more about, you know, ethnic lines than it does about anything previously. There are exceptions in some cases where you could have a really strict, maybe, you know, like a communist system in place, perhaps, like Yugoslavia or something. But look at what happened as soon as they adopted, you know, democracy between, you know, Bosnia, Herzegovina, and then Croatia, Slovenia, Serbia. The Yugoslav wars broke out there, and it was basically, I listened to someone who talked about that the other day, and it was basically right after democracy came in that all hell broke loose, you know?
These multicultural societies can be held together, but only under totalitarianism.
Exactly.
Soviet Union held together this disparate empire for, what, 75 years or whatever it was, but they did so with an iron fist. Stalin knew how to do it. You know, if you stand up, you'll get knocked down. And he had no hesitation about transferring millions of people from one part of the country to another. No hesitation about slaughtering millions of people. That works. If that's what you want to do, if you want to resort to that, you can force unlike peoples to get along with each other. They won't like each other, but they will not dare to rebel against each other. What America's doing, America, which believes in humanitarian democracy, is creating a system in which humanitarian democracy won't be able to work any longer. And we either will have something approaching totalitarianism or constant civil war. Or the third option will be an unhappy place where people have to walk on eggshells all the time for fear of offending someone.
Mm, yeah. That's happening now, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's of course, the host culture, the host people that is expected to stand aside. And it seems like no matter what we do, it's never good enough. We are always in a position, from their point of view, of being in power or holding more over them. It's a system of white supremacy. And I mean, it's like, it just, you know, look at America, despite, you know, affirmative action, despite the fact that white people are pushed out of certain, you know, industries, or they're not welcomed here. They can't do this. They can't do that. They don't get scholarships in the same way they used to. They're not part of the elite schools anymore. It's all diversifying. Despite all these things, despite that, you know, white Americans, white students aren't even allowed to form a student union at some of these universities. You know, despite all those things, and there's much more that can be said about this, they are still seen as a position of having the upper hand in some way. And it becomes so unbearable that these differences, it seems like, are impossible to solve. It's impossible to communicate and find, like, common ground here.
Yeah, well, invasive people who are rising, they can smell weakness a mile away. And if they ask for a concession and get it, then they will ask for another concession. And everybody behaves that way. And that's the way animals behave. You know, a dog will come after you as long as they think you're afraid. Human beings are like that. Muslims or Hispanics, anybody who come into our country illegally and scent weakness, they will jump on it. They know how to take advantage. They'll start making demands. And if you cave in, they make more demands. And they will demand equality. And if they're given equality, they want more than equality. Affirmative action is a good example of a people that want not equality, but more than equality. What they want is discrimination in their favor. And that will be just the beginning of it. People are never satisfied. I mean, I don't fault them for being that way. It's the law of nature. You know, if I were in their situation, I'd be exactly the same. You know, if I were to go to China and ask, you know, for citizenship, and they gave it, then I would ask for voting rights, and if they gave that, then I would ask to be elected to the presidium. And if they gave that, I'd want to be the emperor of China. You know, I mean, people are ambitious. They want to go as far as they can go. They want to realize their potential. It's what Nietzsche called the will to power, which is inevitable and, in fact, necessary. So I don't blame them for wanting it. What I do blame is the weakness, the feebleness of white people who are willing to grant it. They will keep backing up to the cliff until there's no more room in which to back up.
Yeah, yeah. And our naivety, our inability to see that the rules of nature still apply, right? It might come to us through different methods. We have a very much of a kind of a psychological warfare going on top of this, where we are told, you know, that we are root of all these problems in the world. We are told that we have to back away, or that, for example, it's bad for us to take our own side or to look after our interests, right?
If I were given 1 year of absolute power, I would not say that we are equal. I would say that we are superior. And I would push out. And instead of allowing people to take over my land, I'd be taking over their lands. There are plenty of places in the world in which we could expand easily. I would do that. I would set up Western civilization wherever I could. If I could control New Zealand, I would kick out everybody who's not a Caucasian. I would set up the highest culture the world has ever seen. I would not be timid about it. I would say the Caucasian race is infinitely the most superior the world has seen, and it wouldn't be a bad thing if we ruled the globe. That's what I would do. So far, I haven't been offered that opportunity. I don't know why.
Right. If we look at the advancement of Islam in its early stage, primarily when it started to, it's really comes into, existence around 600, 700s, that expands tremendously just in a couple of hundred years. North Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, of course, up in Asia, it starts peering into Europe repeatedly over from that time all the way up to, the 1500s. And, of course, they ruled the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal, for many, many about 700 years it took for them to push back the Muslim forces. And the country was, of course, permanently changed after that. But the way of life, what they imposed there with the jizya, these different taxes and everything like that, it's not happening like that today. It's happening in a different way, but the end results is the same. And I think it's true what you say, Tito, that if we look at it, if we move forward 50 years, if we are demographically displaced in our own countries and pushed out, it'd be very quick, I think, in the sense that they would demand, their own law system, their own monetary thing, their own court system and all these things. They would be more than happy to take over real, real quick.
They can sense weakness. Like I said, they could, when they first began to expand, they saw that the Byzantine Empire was feeble. They saw that Persia was decadent and feeble. They went into those areas and gobbled them up immediately. They ran across North Africa and into Spain, like you say. Wherever weakness appeared, there they came. They were like bacterium, and so is everybody else. People want. They want more than they have. They want to live fuller lives. They can't help it. People want to experience life up to the fullest, and they will do anything they can do. People want to be wealthy. People want to be part of strong countries, and they will do what they have to do. The question is not that they want it, not to blame them for wanting it. The question is how to resist it, how to be strong yourself. Yep. If the West allows itself to be weak, it will get what it deserves. I mean, nuclear weapons won't do the job. You've got to be strong socially and intellectually and in other ways, too. You have to be strong mentally. You have to be confident. And the West is not confident, although it should be. Although the West has achieved more than any other civilization, it ought to be extremely self-confident. But it is diseased and sick. It has been blighted by liberalism, by progressivism, blighted by Christianity, blighted by democracy, blighted by egalitarianism, blighted by humanitarianism, and has become weak and feeble and vulnerable, and is not going to go on very much longer.
Yeah, it's remarkable that many don't see these simple rules of engagement and that nature works is still in the works. We haven't been able to isolate ourselves from that, despite that we live in this very liberalized world that's detached from this reality. But Tito, I wanted to talk a bit more now about your books and give out some websites and whatnot before we take a break here shortly, and then we can continue in the second hour. At that point, I want to ask you more about if this situation that's occurring now in the Western world, if that will force us into a situation so that we're need to become brave again, how to push back, how to kind of adopt some of the properties of the characters that you write about, and specifically in Ruben, of course. But before we do that, then, tell us about some of your novels. Give us some of the titles and where people can go to read more about your work.
Well, anyone can access my book simply by going to Amazon.com and typing in my name. Just type Tito Perdue into Amazon.com, and you will be given a complete list of all my works. or they could go to my personal website, which is www.titopurdue.com, which exposes all of my books and gives a little bit of biography there. That's how to find them if anyone's interested in finding them. To talk about the books themselves, my books are, many of them are semi-autobiographical. And I have created this fictional character named Lee Pethley, who in some ways is like me, but not in all ways. I've made him a good deal more courageous than I am, and a good deal more transgressive than I am. He's what I would like to be in most ways, though not necessarily in all ways. Anyway, he appears in about half of my books. And I show him at different ages, at different levels of development. And in some places, he is really a horrid human being. In others, maybe almost admirable. When Derek Turner was reviewing my books, he said that Lee Pethley was a dreadful human being. And, but Derek's an Englishman, and of course very polite, but he is dreadful in many ways. Anyway, that's the main theme of some of my books. My first book that I published was called, Lee, after my character.
Right.
And it has remained, I think, my most popular work, although it was written, 30 years ago almost. And it was followed up by other books, such as The New Austerities, which I think is one of my better ones, and which is a portrait of Lee and his wife trying to escape New York City and get back down south again. And then I published a book, an experimental book, called Opportunities in Alabama Agriculture, which is a sort of a rural bucolic fantasy about the life of a farmer, the life of a dirt poor farmer in Alabama in the early part of the 20th century.
After the Civil War, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And then I published a book called Fields of Asphodel, which is a dream book about my hero's post-mortem life, where he has to go and receive punishment for all of the evils he has committed while he was alive. It was a kind of a comedy. I published an autobiographical book called The Sweet Scented Manuscript, which is a story of my own college days and my romance with the woman who became my wife and who is sitting beside me right now.
Was that why you were thrown out of college? The first,
exactly.
Right? Yeah. I just read that. I remember that.
Yeah, we had fallen hopelessly in love while we were at college.
Right.
and so one day we met together about 1,000 miles away from school and spent the night together in a hotel room. That was it. I was expelled.
That was enough back then, huh? These days, they're like more, very different, right?
That was more than enough. And that was the most liberal school in America. Antioch,
wow.
The most liberal school in America. But I spent the night with a girl 1,000 miles away from campus when school was not even in session, and I was expelled.
Wow.
So this is a story of how that came about. And then I wrote a book called The Node, which is an ethnocentric novel, a futuristic novel, about a group of Caucasians who are trying to survive and who are trying to set up little colonies in different parts of the United States where they can continue the Caucasian culture and the threats that they suffer under and how they're trying to expand. It's a sort of a science fiction novel. A lot of fun to write it. That was a more recent novel of mine. And then I wrote Reuben. I told you about Reuben. About this Superman who tries to turn history all around. And I think there may be one or two others. That's all I can remember offhand. What's that? Oh, yeah, of course, the first volume of my four-volume set called The collective title is William's House. The first volume is called The Builder. The second volume is called The Churl. The third volume is called The Engineer. And the fourth volume will be called The Bachelor, which is the different stages in the life of the main protagonist. So that's the bulk of them. I have about 10 of them. Oh, yeah, Morning Crafts. My wife just reminded me
right.
of a book that I wrote called Morning Crafts. Oh, yes. That's the story of a gifted young man who was sent off to a special private school. But he's put through an extremely rigorous regimen where he is expected to learn at about three times the rate that most people can be expected to learn, where he learns foreign languages and chemistry and botany and a highly competitive organization designed to promote genius, and how he loves it and thrives, and how the school gets in trouble because it's not part of the general school system, and how the school has to closed down because of that, because it's too good for America. That's one of
right. Yeah.
So that's most of my books.
Yeah, by the way, that from a passage from that, I'm on your site right now. I'm going to read one sentence from the Academy, it turned out, is an actual school run by eccentric curmudgeon. And I can't pronounce that. Sorry, I'm Swedish, so I'm a little bit difficult with some of the words there. Curmudgeonly. Teachers yes. obsessed with training an elite band of boys will grow up with a passion to preserve some vestiges of genuine culture amidst the tide of democratic, egalitarian degeneracy which they see ruining the modern world. So that sounds like much like today, doesn't it?
Yes. It was a very prophetic book. So I wrote it quite a while ago.
All right. Yeah, there you go. Well, I definitely want to ask you more about these, some of the concept and, of course, what inspires you. I definitely want to ask you a bit more about the node as well in the second segment. But, yeah, the website, folks, is titoperdue.com. We'll have the links up, and we'll add some links to Amazon as well, to the books. A lot for you to dig into there, so do check it out if you want to read some, you know, some novels on some of these, you know, topics that we discuss on the show as well. We do a lot of, you know, nonfiction books, of course, but it's great to dive into, you know, novels now and then as well and get a different flavor to all of this stuff. So, very good. Okay, well, stay with us. Stay with us, Tito. We'll be taking a short break here, and then we'll be right back with you. Don't miss hour two. We have much more coming with Tito Perdue. Hey, that rhymes. So in the members hour, we look at the impending extinction of Western culture as we know it. We get into the ills of feminism and the realities of self-segregation between different cultures, along with the destructive transformation of America that began with the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965. Now, Tito emphasizes the downfalls of so-called diversified civilizations and says that the globalists' control of the media is to blame for promoting the war on whites and the heinous policies designed to discriminate against the founding stock of the U.S. We also spend some time talking about propaganda-filled Hollywood movies that are destroying the true history and mythos of European culture. We also get Tito's take on what can be done about all the problems we've discussed. Our member section is full of good stuff for you. Over 1,000 radio shows, interviews, research, and opinion. We also have insights, episodes, videos, films, and much more coming in this area. So join us at redicemembers.com. Sign up, tune in, and download or stream. We'll kick up right after the break. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back.